Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at 3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hey, it's Jesse. Just want to let you know in the interview you're going to hear, Sarah mistakenly identified a radio host who was fired for making racist tweets. She said it was Opie, but it was in fact Opie's former co-host, Anthony Cumio. Hi, hello, how's it going? Yeah, I know. But welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Vulture Senior Editor, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, a comedian comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discusses how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. Sometimes the jokes are small, like a baby, but you know, like a small baby. The joke will be a minute long, maybe two, will be a one-liner or two-liner. I think for the Neil Brennan episode, it was like a short 3-second throwaway line. Other times, the jokes are big babies. I know as a former big baby. Jen Kirkman, Bill Burr, Tig Notaro, they all had jokes well over 10 minutes. No one touches Gary Goldman, whose joke was an unbelievable 25 minutes, but this week's joke definitely tries. The joke writer in question, my guest today, is stand-up comedian, TV writer, and soon-to-be author, Sarah Schaefer. The subject is her 16.5-minute magnum opus about her first trip to Hobby Lobby, the infamous arts and crafts store who's best known for winning a Supreme Court case that allowed them to offer health insurance policies that excluded covering certain birth controls. Last week, our guest Daniel Sloss spoke about the Edinburgh Fringe Festival from the perspective of a UK comedian and how they're expected to bring a new show there every year. In this episode, Sarah talks about what the festival is like for comedians coming from America who try their hands at adapting their style to something that leans closer to the one-person show. To set the scene, Sarah started working on the joke in early 2017, before performing it as part of her Edinburgh show that summer. However, the version you'll hear is from her 2019 album, Live, Laugh, Love. Since there are a few versions of the joke floating around, we get the name of one of her fictional characters mixed up a few times, but don't worry, we figure it out eventually. Sarah and I spoke in February of this year. So, here is Sarah Schaefer. Enjoy! Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It seems like the majority of the joke we're going to talk about was written between May and August 2017.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to start a little before then and the election of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote a piece for the Scotland Herald 6 months into his presidency that I loved, that I felt was the first thing to really capture what I had been feeling as a consumer of comedy, and I'd eventually write about myself. And the title was Why Trump Jokes Aren't Funny.
Can I comment on that
Sure. Really
quickly? I did not choose that title, and
sure,
I was actually very angry about it because I hate when people say blank jokes aren't funny.
Yeah. To say aren't funny implies
that they can possibly be funny. Of course they can.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I imagine your feelings have evolved, but I want to sort of first start where you were at that moment. Can you talk about those first few months, what that felt like you and, as you describe, audiences, buttholes?
Yeah. It really started during the election year when I was on the road a lot. And I was also on the road a lot in 2017. And I would perform in a lot of different venues in not just clubs, colleges, festivals. Like, just I was really doing it all. And I am not famous enough to have my own hardcore fan base that would fill those spaces. So I'm, and even to this day, I'm still mostly performing for a random collection of people. And some people come in there without knowing anything about me because they're idiots.
And they're just like, time to go to a comedy show. They don't, and you're a comedy show.
You don't go, oh, I'm going to go see music tonight and not at least determine the genre and get mad when you're in there. And you're like, I didn't want to see death metal. What is this? You know, I want my money back. Like, so I have people who come and don't know anything about me. And so I would, during that time, I was contending with a lot of prickly reactions to just the most minor mentions of things. Like I had a joke about that very topic, about how you can't say anything on the internet without some blowhard coming by and getting mad about Hillary Clinton. And because I literally saw a picture of the Grand Canyon, like the most beautiful picture I'd ever seen of the Grand Canyon. A rainbow is going down into the Grand Canyon. It was posted by the Department of the Interior. So it's like the nerdiest people in the government are posting a really pretty picture of one of our great treasures.
Yeah.
And the first comment, and it said like storm approaching the Grand Canyon or whatever. And the very first comment underneath, I just happened to look, was like, you want to see a storm coming? Check out filthy Hillary Clinton. You know, it's just like, not even the Grand Canyon can post a picture without someone getting pissed off. So when I was telling that story for a while, and just the mention of her name, people couldn't even hear what I was saying. And I remember one dude cupped his ears, closed his eyes, and started going, like shaking his head like a little fucking kid who was like, you know, being confronted with like something naughty. And he was so childish. And I remember seeing that face. I'll never forget it. And just being like, oh, you can't even say anything. Like I haven't even made a comment about whether or not I like her or not. And this person is already reacting. And it just made it really hard to even get to the point when you're already feeling, I'm an extremely sensitive person. Like I really can tell in a room, like tight buttholes, like I can, it's, and it's been a big challenge for me, comedically speaking. But
I guess describe to those who don't know what you mean by tight buttholes.
Like you can just feel an energy in a room of, wow, some of these people hate me. Like there's a searing hatred, or there's body language, or just a tenseness in the room. And sometimes it's just silence that's telling you that, you know, that they're just not responding in any way. And so I got really afraid of that feeling. I hate that feeling. My job as a comedian is to make people laugh and feel loose and joy. And I'm not someone who enjoys, I like building tension and breaking it, but this was not letting me do that. It was just an immediate knee-jerk reaction, or you just, you can't, you know. And Nikki Glaser, in that piece, I asked her a question, and she was like, I don't want to bring it up because I don't want to know who in the audience likes Donald Trump, because then I can't stand that person.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's from a personal place of hating her audience.
Yeah.
So it's everyone. And since then, I've made jokes like, you know, you really could start a civil war in a comedy club right now. Just like say something really crazy and just fight and leave.
Yeah. I mean, as you mentioned the piece, which I thought was really good, which is that it's not just the people that don't like him or don't want to hear the joke. It's that literally that, like, even if people agree with you, you're just like, I don't want this now.
Well, yeah, because you're in a room with other people, and now everyone knows, based on who's laughing and who's upset, who's who.
Yeah.
And you don't want that. You don't want to be, I'm like, I wouldn't, in a comedy club, I wouldn't be like, oh my God, I'm sitting next to, like, people I can't stand and I think are actually, like, could potentially be racist, you know?
Like, it, like, breaks the entire idea of a comedy club, which is, like, you're going to laugh with other people.
And be united as a group. And so it is very, it divides.
Yeah. One other question before we play the joke. What is your history with crafts?
Oh, crafting. Well, I've been crafting my whole life. I love doing things with my hands. I just love making things. I love measuring. I love threads, patterns. I love following patterns. It brings me great peace.
How did you start?
Just as a child, as a little girl, you are encouraged as a girl to pursue things with threads and cloth and making and painting and dollhouses and, you mm-hmm. know, like anything like that. But as an adult, it really started just a need for a hobby and to have something to do while I'm watching TV. And part of it was living in New York for a long time. I would crochet on the subway mm-hmm. to pass the time. And now I enjoy cross stitch the most, or any kind of tiny embroidery type stuff, because I'm not very good at designing my own unless it's very simple. Mm-hmm. I'm not an artist in that way. I'm more of a craft person who can follow other people's grand designs.
So let's listen to the story of you and your journey to find a basket.
You know, for me, one of the things I struggle with the most is that I want so badly to be pure. Why is that funny? I'm not talking sexually pure. No, 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 no. That ship has sailed, okay? I mean, like, ideologically pure. You know, I like to think of myself as a good person. I volunteer. I donate. I vote. I use my legitimate outrage against injustice in the world, and I try to turn it into action. You know, I do that. But it never feels like it's enough. And I always worry that just one slip up will erase all the good I've done. That's the black and white world I feel like we live in right now, and especially for me and my particular brand of anxiety that I'm working on in therapy. So when I want to give you an example of this in my life and how it plays out. I recently faced a real crisis of conscience while creating a craft nook in my home. I'll explain. A craft nook, if you're not familiar, is when you become overwhelmed with a desire to create an area in your home, a nook, if you will, where you can display your crafting supplies in an organized and adorable manner. Now, it's completely customizable. You can put little shelves and hooks, little baskets to store all your different supplies. I have all my embroidery floss on clothespins arranged by color on little clotheslines. How many of you are getting a little bit wet right now? I'm dripping. So while I was building Craft Nook, that's its name. First name Craft, last name Nook. While I was building Craft Nook, there was an empty area. There was a hole, a void. And I knew what went there. I needed like a little basket, like a thing to hold stuff in that I could hang there. Something vintage looking, something rustic, like the kind of thing you'd collect eggs in on an old farm. Obviously. That's what went there. I had a vision. So I'm driving around Los Angeles to all the big stores. You know, in America, we've got it good. We have one store the size of a city block per type of item. Like, we've got BevMo. They only sell beverages. Dick's. They only sell dicks. Just kidding. They sell sporting goods to dicks. For crafting, ooh. The list is long. We've got Joann's, we've got Michael's, Blick, the list goes on and on. But I'm driving around and I can't find this basket and I'm getting pissed. I'm like, what am I supposed to do? Go home and order it on Amazon and get it delivered via drone in 1 hour? I want it now. So frustrating. So I'm about to give up and head home. And then just then, like across the street, I see a store, a big store, a store I've never seen before, but I've heard of it because it's been in the news. It's called a Hobby Lobby. No, you don't know. You don't know what happened. So for those of you who don't, who didn't just groan, for those of you who don't know, Hobby Lobby was in the news because they went, it's a chain of retail stores, a corporation that went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States of America to prove that they hate women. Now that's just my interpretation of it. Their interpretation would be different. They would say they went to the Supreme Court to fight for what they believe to be their right to refuse to cover certain kinds of birth control for their female employees on religious grounds because they believe that those types of birth control are literally abortion. Now, they're allowed to believe that. I'm allowed to disagree with that and think that what they did was dangerous and set a very dangerous precedent for to open the door for all kinds of discrimination. That's just what I believe. So forget what you believe. We're not here to debate that stuff. But given what I've just told you, should I be shopping in a Hobby Lobby? No. Fuck Hobby Lobby. Resist and persist, bitch. Don't clap yet. But there I am, standing in front of a Hobby Lobby. I'm already out of the car. I'm like, what's in there? I mean, I'm ready to fight, but I don't even know what it is that they sell. I should know my enemy, right? I should at least figure out what the Hoblob's about. I should get in there. I'm not going to touch anything. I'm not going to buy anything. Maybe I'll fuck shit up a little. Maybe I'll hide some plan B in the merchandise for the employees to find. Everything's going to be cool. So I go in, and the first thing I'm confronted with in the lobby of the Hobby Lobby, I'm not even in the store yet, is this display of all of these little like chest of drawers, like little dressers. They look like antique vintage like card catalogs. You know what I mean? They're like reclaimed barnwood and each drawer is a different color. I see it and I'm just like... What is this place? Oh, it's cute. Engage your core. You will not be broken, Schaefer. Just do this. We can do this. I go in, and I was not ready. I don't know if you've been inside a Hobby Lobby. I was not ready. It is the most extravagant, insane, big craft store you've ever seen. It's bananas. They have everything. Cardstock, strings, glues, glitters, ornaments. Oh, year round. They had Halloween decorations out in May. They had a whole aisle of wicker baskets. Buy one, get 10 free. Fuck. They had dollhouse furniture. Didn't see that coming. And all of it just doused in the blood of Christ. It was just intense. I'm going through the store and I'm just kind of shaking and sweating because I truly am like, it's a wonderland for someone like me. I'm just like, this is incredible. It's like meeting your enemy and then like immediately falling in love with them. It's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to feel. I'm going through the store kind of shaking like, this isn't fair. I get to the middle of the store and I come upon the biggest display I've ever seen. Of one type of item. It's like the size of this club. And what it was inspirational quotes. And it wasn't just on driftwood, it was on everything. They had inspirational quotes on anything they could fit words on. Mailboxes, rocking horses, spinning wheels. Spinning wheels, that's hard to do. They did it. And that's when I was grounded right back in my reality. I was like, nah, fuck you, Hobby Lobby. I'm out. I made a beeline for the parking lot, but before I could get out of the store, it was like a ray of angel light shone down upon the basket that I needed for Craft Nook. The exact thing I had imagined was right there. And I was like, oh, no. I look at the price tag and $2.99, damn it. Ah, it's such a good deal.
I wrestled with my conscience for a good 1 to 2 seconds, picked it up, got in line, bought it, get in my car, start driving home. Halfway home, it hits me what I've done. I'm like, what the hell? You fake-ass feminist! You are such a hypocrite. You didn't last a second. You live a life of privilege, and you just fucked it all up. You just let it all go. This is why Trump won. No, it's worse. I'm Trump. That's the thing. I think we don't like to admit it, but all of us have a little bit of Trump in our psyche. We get some of the stuff he does. We're like, I might do that if I was in that position. Admit it. It's like, we can't help it. Like Sigmund Freud, he came up with the parts of the personality, like ego, super ego, id. He forgot one, the Trump. The Trump is in the wind. The Trump is when you lose your convictions. You see candy and you just take it. You don't last 2 feet. You're just in the wind. Whenever Trump does a press conference, I always imagine him behind a curtain, like before he comes out, with his people. And they're like smacking him in the face and throwing water on him and being like, say it again! He's like, Nazis are bad. Say it again! Nazis are bad. One more time. Nazis are bad. Okay, go, 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 go. He gets up to the podium. He's like, some of the Nazis are very fine people. It's like, ah! He didn't last 2 feet! That's the Trump. I was the Trump in that moment. I didn't last 2 feet. Going with a plan, it just goes to shit. I got home. I put the basket in Kraft Nook. It looked awesome. When I was feeling kind of guilty every time I looked at it. And no joke, that same week, Hobby Lobby popped up in the news again. This time, because they got in trouble. They got caught buying stuff illegally off the black market. Smuggling. What were they buying? Ancient tablets from Iraq. Old pieces of rock. I know. I was just as confused as you are at this point. I'm like, why does Hobby Lobby need these old things from Iraq? Like, are they going to put inspirational quotes on them and sell them? Like, that seems like a bad over-under. Okay. But then I kept reading, and they're like, no, Hobby Lobby has been trying to buy up all the old artifacts from the time of the Bible. This is true. So they could bring it back to America, where it belongs. As we know, Jesus is American. And they wanted to put all their old stuff that they could find into their Bible museum. This is real. Hobby Lobby, the people who own Hobby Lobby, opened a Bible museum in D.C. You can go to it right now. Now, this is the point where I started actually feeling empathy and sadness for Hobby Lobby. Because I was like, I mean, who amongst us? Like, seriously, think about it. If you were opening a museum, you would do anything you could to get at least one old thing in there. Why? You can't have a museum and not have one artifact in there. Otherwise, just build a website. Save us all time. The museum is so you can go be in the same room as something musty and old. That's why you go there. So they were like clearly desperate. Like I love imagining the president of Hobby Lobby like in a conference room, like pissed off, pounding his fist on the table, like, I don't care how you get it, Cynthia, but we need something in the museum that Jesus, our Lord and Savior, personally touched. Now you go get it. I don't care how you get it. If you don't get it, you can find yourself a new job. Later that night, Cynthia's at her laptop shaking, like, Lord Jesus, got my hands on the interweb. Please help me find something that you touched for our museum. And now she's on the dark web somehow. Oh, where am I? Oh, help me. Help me, sir. Help me. And then someone helps her and she gets what she needs. I honestly think that's literally how it happened. And then they got caught. They got in trouble for it. But I was reading this, and I was like, well, this is interesting. Because I always kind of thought of Hobby Lobby, even if I disagree with them, I mean, they're hardcore, you know? they spent years and years of time and millions of dollars, I assume, in legal fees to go all the way to the Supreme Court to change the laws of our land around their beliefs. That's commitment. You got to admit, they're walking their walk. They're living by their ideals. They are living the word of God as they see it. But last I checked, the Bible also says, thou shalt not steal, bitch. So now I'm thinking I can keep that basket in Craft Nook and we're fine. Somehow even there. But then things got even more complicated, trickier, and that a new detail about this story came out, which was who they were doing business with on this black market. Now, who do you think Hobby Lobby, a Christian, American, patriotic, family values, far-right company would like to be doing business with? Like, who do they want to be buying and selling things with? Like, who do they want to be, like, chumming up with? ISIS? Was that a guess? No? Well, that's who it was. And I know Cynthia didn't realize it was ISIS. I know she didn't know. But they were literally giving money to ISIS. That's insane! I'm like kind of laughing about it. I'm like, that is so crazy. But then I'm like staring at Craft Nook and I'm like, I'm ISIS! I thought, how am I going to make this work where everyone gets what they want? Okay, I'm going to keep the basket. It was $2.99. It's just a drop in the bucket. But to make things right, I'm going to put my birth control in the basket. That's where I keep it. And, you know, Hobby Lobby, I get it. They wanted to make their museum perfect. I wanted my Craft Nook to be perfect. From now on, let's just agree to no longer do business with terrorists. Just going forward, let's not do that again.
And we're back after listening to that joke. What a funny joke.
What a journey. Okay, so this was all leading to Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which I did in August 2017. And probably a year prior is when I started making Craft Nook physically in my home. And
so a year prior to Edinburgh?
To Edinburgh.
So this
and then I decided I was going to do Edinburgh in like January of 2017. And they make you like send in your name of the show and a brief concept like right away. And they were like, don't worry, if you don't have it figured out, it's fine. You just have to make it loosely. Like that's part of what Hannah Gatsby's Nanette, the title Nanette, is she'd come up with the title before writing the show.
Oh, that's why she says, I thought there's going to be a lot of material there.
Yeah. So apparently at Edinburgh, this is very common. Like people will submit their show without having written it. And some people are like writing it the day before, which I did not do, thank God. But
and to a little explain, Edinburgh is a festival in Scotland that is a comedian goes and they do 30 straight days of shows, and they tend to be more one-person showy.
Yeah,
but
an hour. They encourage you. Or, well, look, you can do whatever you want. There's all kinds of shows. There's music, there's theater, there's drama, plays, total insanity.
Yeah.
I literally like 10,000 shows a day. I'm not exaggerating. Like, that's what you're up against. But I did sort of a hybrid stand-up and loosely themed show, and it was called Little White Box. And
so in January, you knew you were working.
I knew the loose themes, and
which were
like it was like Trump, Jesus, and America. Like I had like two jokes, you know, written that I built around, which is a great challenge for me because I'd never written around a theme or to a specific purpose like that before. I think I was doing this podcast thing, experimenting with my own new podcast, and I was just blabbing about it, Craft Nook, on my podcast, and then I was like, oh, that could be a joke, and I tried it out, and
just the Craft Nook part, Hobby Lobby.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, it was just me talking about Craft Nook. And then
is
Hobby
that where
Lobby,
so the Craft Nook, the name of it as a entity was that part of the joke was one of the first parts of the joke.
Yes. And then Hobby Lobby came into it because I was putting it together and I was like, it was the first time I'd been in a Hobby Lobby and I was just completely horrified at how incredible it was. And so it was probably January or February.
So you're in the Hobby Lobby.
Yeah.
Are you, by the time you step foot, you're like, this is going to be material immediately, sort of?
No, I didn't. I was in there feeling those feelings. Yeah. I was like, this isn't fair. I hate how cool this store is. And cool is very open to interpretation there. I was completely focused on the task at hand, which was decorating Craft Nook. I was not thinking about anything to do with jokes.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that's usually how I am with material up until this point with doing this Edinburgh show, which is just, it wouldn't occur to me until years later that something that had happened in my life could be a joke, a story I've been telling friends. Yeah. And then suddenly I'll be on stage one night and I'll go, oh, I should tell that story and just see.
Yeah.
But this time period, I was specifically writing jokes, but I still was mining older experiences. So the Hobby Lobby thing kind of came in like, ooh, I could talk about this and maybe tie it together with this theme of a show.
Mm-hmm.
And then the joke just became so long. And now, I mean, it's even, I can't even do the joke anymore because it's too long. And it's
so it keeps
really,
on growing,
can
even
only
though you,
work yeah. in certain settings. If I feel comfortable, because it does touch on things that I think are, for me, a little edgy, meaning like abortion and I do, you know, reveal that I'm, first off, if you come see me perform and in the first 10 seconds you don't know that I'm a liberal feminist, you're not paying attention just by what I look like.
Yeah.
And how I talk and stuff, but you never know. But, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot going on in this joke and like stuff. Oh, and this, all the stuff with Hobby Lobby. Literally, I started talking about the experience of going in there and the feeling of like, oh my God, I'm not supposed to be shopping in this store politically. Like I should be boycotting Hobby yeah. Lobby, but I'm in here and I love it. And I have to buy this thing because it's what I need. And then I believe all that stuff where they got caught,
like yes.
smuggling stuff. It happened then.
Yeah,
like in 2017, right?
Yeah, July 2017.
Yes. So I was like down the path. Yeah. So I had to add this stuff in.
Yeah.
And it was just so intense. And then, like, even after Edinburgh, like new stuff has happened, which I didn't add on the album because it had literally just happened and I didn't have time yeah. to get it in. But like, also some of the documents that like old archival ancient documents that they had found in the Bible Museum were fake. And so I made this whole segment where Cheryl is like dipping paper into tea. You know, when you're growing up and you yeah. made old documents and you dip it in tea and then you singe the edges with like a match. I would like do a whole act out of her doing that. I'm like, Lord, guide me to make these documents old looking.
I mean, something about you talking about it is a very Romeo and Juliet-esque story. A love story between you and this basket and then sort of the families. Yeah. So the joke has seven sections as it's recorded.
Wow, you deconstructed my joke. I love it.
Clearly, it has yeah. not only they have seven sections, but they very neatly follow a hero's journey. Save the catch.
I love it.
So I will go through it. So yes. People listening, just so you don't know what Save the Cat is, because apparently it is not famous. There is this book called Save the Cat that is like the intro to screenwriting book of the last 20 years that very clearly lines out the beat of a classic sort of Hollywood movie. But the hero's journey is a sort of the classic story structure. And this follows one, which is section one is purity, which is the setup. Then Craft Nook, which is the catalyst or call to action. Stores, the section where you talk about the stores. That is the debate. The debate continues into the section about the about Hobby Lobby section, which is also ends with the cross the threshold moment. Then inside the Hobby Lobby is what the book calls fun and games or promise of the premise.
Right.
It is the second act of the story. Then all the Trump is all's lost, Dark Night of the Soul. and then the Hobby Lobby Museum is the finale. I can't imagine you thought of it this way, but maybe did. But how aware are you of when you're thinking about this, especially with Edinburgh, of like the structure, this story?
I am not that aware. I'm vaguely aware of it.
Yeah.
But I think one of my best skills in writing and in stand-up is storytelling. And I've fought against it for years because storytelling naturally also can lead to long and length. And when you're coming up in comedy, there's a period where you are being pressured to do very short, bite-sized
sets. Might have like 5 minutes.
5 minutes for Montreal, 5 minutes for your audition, 5 minutes for a late-night set. And things happened in my career and people said things that made me think I had to abandon my storytelling, which is what I started out as, essentially. I would do structured stories with jokes and payoffs that would fill my entire 10 minutes or 8 minutes, however long I was getting at the
time. I mean, even if you got 15 minutes now, this story is still too long for 15 minutes.
So this type of joke is my favorite, but now finally I'm in a place in my career where I think I have the ability to just go back to my roots. But I've always been a natural storyteller. And when I first wrote my first television script, I was overwhelmed with the structure. And then when I was done with it, I realized I already knew inherently because I consume so much of this stuff. I think some people think they know too, and then they don't. But I actually do. I think I actually do. It just feels
right. Well, I told you that you did. So I think
I know. You've confirmed it for me.
So you mentioned Edinburgh. When you say you wrote to the assignment, what does that sort of mean in practice? Are you like sitting down?
Yes. I was transcribing my set.
So you'd record and then listen to it back.
And typing it out. And I've done this process before, but not on such an intense level for so long. Like for my first album, I transcribed all my jokes and I tweaked them typing wise and, you know, worked on it that way. But this was like extended for like a full 6 months of just like really intensely every night recording it, listening back, tweaking the script. I had like I had a script.
Yeah,
and so much of the writing came down to transition and making it feel like a cohesive show, which I barely accomplished. I feel like I barely accomplished that. After going to Edinburgh and seeing other people's shows and seeing what I could do, I realized that stringing together a full hour of stand-up in a way that feels like its own show that really has a cohesive theme, I could have done more. And maybe if I had started, like, okay, I'm going to write a show about Jesus and just do that, that would have been easier than what I had done, which was I have three jokes I really like and I want to tell them.
And there's someone adjacent to each other.
Yeah, and there's a lot in my Edinburgh show. There's stuff that's like my Christian upbringing. There's stuff about my mom dying. These are and a lot of material I've now have put on hold that I can't wait to go back to, but I don't know what to do with it yet. So,
had you been exposed to this? I mean, I think it's important context-wise, which is sort of like, in the UK and in Australia, this sort of form is the standard.
Yes.
Had you been exposed to those type of comedians before you went into it?
I had done Melbourne
for
2 weeks the year prior, and that was my first exposure to those shows. But it really wasn't until Edinburgh that I saw this sort of... I saw Nanette there in person, and it was truly one of the best shows I've ever seen, and I will physically fight any comedian. I will meet you at the stand on Thursday night. I don't think this is going to be out before, but
no,
I'll be back.
We're going to leak this clip.
Leak it. Tag people that you know will be triggered by it.
Yeah,
you know, we know who we're talking about.
Yeah, we do.
No, I loved Nanette. I thought it was an incredible piece of not only performance, but also comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And my father watched Nanette, and he is a 73-year-old lifelong Republican, white man, Southerner, and he loved it. He was like, it was incredible. So I'm just saying, you know, I think if you go into it with a preconceived notion and attitude, then you might not like it. But anyway, that show. I saw a lot of shows in Edinburgh, and some were good and some weren't, but I saw what people were doing. And I saw the whole range of, you know, quality and what made the better ones better and what made the weaker ones weaker. And
did it change how you approached even this story, which is a longer piece?
It definitely let me tell that. I would not have developed that joke, the Hobby Lobby thing, as much as I did if I hadn't done Edinburgh. And it is one of my favorite jokes I've ever told because I think I'm actually saying something for real in it. And it's funny. And I I'm like, it could be funnier. I should keep going back to it. But I don't know what it's on this album. And I don't know what to do with it now. But and it's like I can't even put it online. I could put a video on YouTube. And now I guess there's IGTV to let you go longer. I don't know. But it seems like a lot of work to caption that. You know what I mean? I don't have time for that shit.
We'll be right back with more Sarah Schaefer.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Summarize with AI in a click.
Click, 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 click.
Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
And we're back. So I want to go section by section and talk about the parts and sort of the thinking that went into it.
Mm-hmm.
So section one, purity, setup.
Yeah.
You know, in interviews, you've talked about how you have a complicated relationship with rules and being good.
Yeah.
I feel like this section seems to be really a clear distillation of this. Can you talk about sort of that history, sort of how Trump did or did not disrupt that, and how to sort of then distill it into this idea of purity?
Well, I've done a lot of thinking on this because I did just finish a memoir that comes out in August that has a lot of this in it. Not a ton, but a little bit of it. I had a traumatic incident in childhood involving my dad. Wherein, and I don't want to give it too much away because it's like a big part of my book.
Sure.
But spoiler alert, you're going to have to fucking buy the book.
Yeah.
Because I put so much work into it. But I had things happen growing up. I was predispositioned to be a rule follower, genetically speaking. I don't, you know, personality, they don't know 100% where it comes from, but this was already part of my personality baked in the moment I came out. And then I had this traumatic incident involving my father where he made a huge mistake and he had to rebuild his whole life and we had to go with him. Mm-hmm. And it was really big and for a 12-year-old me especially, but for my whole family. And after that,
just to not be too, can you say the general interest?
It involved finance.
Great.
He made a big
mistake.
I just
feel like people will be like, did her dad murder somebody?
No, he did not murder anyone.
Great.
He made a mistake and he made a very wrong, morally wrong choice that he then corrected, which was the part that I think most people, that's a very unique, just from me talking to people, it's a unique experience where someone comes forward and is like, I've made a mistake before anyone, he didn't get caught, he like stopped it. He was like, hey, I've been doing this and I have to stop. And and come what may, I can't live like this anymore.
Yeah.
And that hardened in me this idea that, one, you do something wrong, it will destroy everything. And then when you do right, it corrects everything. Mm-hmm. And it was just very black and white to me as a 12-year-old. And then at the same time, I became radically in love with Jesus Christ.
It was famous for doing things right. It's
yeah.
good.
And so all of that sort of settled in. And then me also inherently wanting to be good. You know, got to say, Taylor Swift's new documentary, I did not expect to feel what I felt watching that. I have a complicated relationship with her. And I really loved her for a while. And then the last two albums, musically, I just didn't like them as much. And then things, you know, there was all this stuff about her. And I just started to kind of not as like her as much. But I watched this documentary and I could not have felt more empathy and related to her on, because she talks in it about always wanting to be perceived as good.
Yeah.
And I felt that it was interesting that she chose the words perceived as good, because she knows she's not perfect and she's a flawed human being, but she doesn't want anyone to ever see those flawed parts. And I relate to that a lot. And I felt myself crying for her. And I'm back in love with Taylor Swift now. I still want different music from her.
Sure, of course.
It doesn't like hit me the way her older stuff does. But yeah. But yeah, I was just like this. And then it and social media, to your question, social media, especially when Trump hit, is when all of this really blew up for me. In that it was a recipe for disaster, in that I felt compelled to speak out on every single little thing that I felt was morally my duty to speak up about and to fight the wrong and the bad. But what I realized, because at the same time I was also starting, in 2015 I started therapy, a new kind, like I did, started doing cognitive behavioral therapy to deal with all of these issues with me, which had come to a real bad place in like 2015. I was very, very depressed, and it was all taking this stuff apart. So I'm already evolving and maturing at this point and really starting to deal with my black and white thinking, all or nothing, good or bad, you're evil or you're, you know, these the thing I distilled much more eloquently in the beginning of this joke. And so then I'm working on all this, and I see it happening on Twitter with everyone around me. And now I was like, oh, I thought this was just my thing. And,
yeah.
And now I'm seeing it happen to everyone, and everyone's being sucked in, and I'm still have this relationship with it and struggle. And social media was punishing me in that we are having so many purity tests on, and it's still happening, but like, you're either with us or you're against us. Yeah. You know, if you do this, you aren't good anymore. And it was a lot for me, like, especially like I remember really feeling it very intensely after Trump was elected around the Women's March, because there was so much criticism of the Women's March, and I had gone, and I was suddenly deciding that I was bad for going because I was a white woman. I didn't wear a pussy hat, I know, but I was feeling really intensely. I felt I would read a tweet that criticized white women at the Women's March, and I would take it as a criticism of me.
Yeah.
And even though I knew some of it did apply to me and some of it didn't, I would just suddenly decide, okay, well, that's bad, but what am I supposed to, you know? And I remained silent because I knew it's not about my feelings, you know, in that situation, centering myself, those things. I'm always trying to follow these rules.
Yeah.
But I realized it was just destroying me. I wouldn't be able to do anything during the day because I'd be thinking about this stuff all day long.
How do you then make it so it's, you know, it's like a minute of this joke? How do you get like, okay, have all of this, as you explained, it's like the entirety of your thing, and now it's also happening to society. How do you get to like, okay, purity is sort of this idea. Purity will be the word I'll use. Yeah. Black and white world that I feel like we're in right now, and especially for me and my particular brand of anxiety that I'm working through therapy, and like, that's the thing. Let me just say, how do you, is that, you've talked about, you go on, say, you talk about a why, and like, okay, these sentences get to it?
Yeah. I mean, there was a really messy version at first where I was trying, because I realized I needed to set up the stakes. And that's a huge part of storytelling is to explain the stakes. And I really learned this with my book too, which is like, why are we, why is this important? Why do we care? Why are we here? and I had to make that clear to the audience. And so that's actually can be a problem for me, is I over explain things, but I felt with this story it needed to be explained. Otherwise it would just be like, what are we talking about crafting for? Why are we getting into this? And I think it that really developed from doing it in Edinburgh. I needed a way to transition between what was before that joke into this. And it was the stuff that came before was about social media purity tests and trolling and how angry people get online. And so I was transitioning into this, I think. I might be misremembering the order. But yeah. But yeah, so that's distilling it down took actual, like, I had to sit there and write it. Better, because I would read when I would transcribe, I would naturally start editing myself and I'd be like, no, write it down how you said it so you can see how fucking terrible it is, you dumb bitch. I have a great inner monologue.
Yeah, you're very mean to yourself. You're a very harsh editor to yourself. But what it does, and I want to, as we talk into sort of section two, Craft Nook, Catalyst, the call to action, the first sort of big laugh you get in the joke sort of is the beginning. It's
15 minutes in. No,
is the
odd choice.
So you sort of build up this sort of idea of purity, which there's some laughs in it, but it sort of really is set up. And then he goes, I recently faced a real crisis of conscience while creating a craft nook in my home. And that sort of was a laugh.
Yeah.
And it what is nice, and I think what the first part of the joke does, is it's a sort of persona laugh. It's not like a joke. It's a and I think you need that part to be like trying to get teach these people who is a type of person who would care this much about the things you're about to hear. I know you've talked about, I've heard you talk about in different times, in different interviews, struggling to be like, what is my persona? What is the sort of thing that people take away from me?
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean with this joke? That if it is helpful to sort of like what it does to get the audience to be like, I know the type of person this is.
Yeah. It's, this doing the Edinburgh show and all my material since then has been way better, a way better depiction of who I am. And not just me as a mirror or an observer. And, you know, I've told jokes, all my jokes have been personal in about my life or whatever, but they don't necessarily tell you who I am in an easy to understand way. They're just like, here's something that happened to me.
Yeah.
These jokes feel more like, this is who I am, the core of my being, you know? And it feels like I'm moving into this, like, place where I am someone who is maybe an elderly woman deep down. And I like crafting and gardening and miniatures and soothing and warmth and maternal, but I'm not a mother, you know, that, but that means my maternal love is for everyone. I don't reserve it for my own offspring. You know, I've been moving into this, like, this is sort of my core. And then, that I'm someone who's come past this moral anxiety. I have it, but I have learned how to deal with it. And so I think this joke is, Hobby Lobby is about confronting it. And everything since has been, you know, being more comfortable with who I am and showing that.
You've said that sometimes in your voice on stage you'll see your mother, and maybe that's not necessarily the case anymore. You said this in an interview a while ago, but do you feel like that's maybe part of
it? I have no idea what you're talking about. Really? No.
I was like, which is fine.
No, I don't remember anything I've said.
I mean, it's like one interview you said in like 2013. But
Yeah.
You said it was.
Creep.
Yeah.
Jesse has been stalking me, and I've never been more flattered and turned on. Sorry.
So considering you said that once, you feel like that holds true. Is that what you think that is part of the maternal instinct you're feeling?
I performed at Acme Comedy Co. in Minneapolis, and some people came that I know, not well, but I know them, and they told me after, it was like the best feedback I've ever gotten. They were like, you have so much empathy for your audience. And I was just like, thank you for noticing. Because I do. I'd want people to have a good time. Yeah. And I think right now there's so much arguing about what comedy should be, which is, you're already off the wrong foot if you're going what comedy should be, because it's art and there's nothing that, you're already lost if you're having that conversation. But there's a lot of people who are very strongly pushing the idea that comedy should anger people and offend, that it should do that.
Yeah.
That if you're not doing that, you're not telling the truth. You're not saying what everyone's thinking. It's like, well, I don't think everyone's thinking those things. In fact, I think a lot of people aren't, and that's why they're mad, okay? But I think my comedy just isn't that, and so I've felt, in the past, I've felt so, like, down on, like, I'm not doing it right, and I'm not, it must mean I'm not funny. Mm-hmm. It is possible to be a loving person on stage and be funny. There are so many examples.
There's a part of this section where the punchline is that you're a little bit wet, right now because I'm dripping. And I want to point out, because I feel like your previous album was much more sexual.
Yeah, it was.
And can you talk about sort of the evolution away from that? Also, sort of,
well, I stopped having sex.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's
but how do you decide to then still use it here and there?
I think that I just write about what is going on and what I'm interested in. And my first album was, that material was largely written right after I got divorced and I was single for the first time as an adult. And it was just so much fun to talk about on stage. It was a moment, it was a time of discovery for myself and exploration in every way. And it was so fun to talk about it on stage. And I was also like, I mean, I wasn't trying to be sexy on stage or anything, because I think my material about it is not exactly alluring.
Yeah.
And those who are allured by it, I'm suspicious of. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever. People can be turned on by me if they want to be. I'll take it. But it was a very different album. And I think in some ways my material moved into I hate the word clean, because it's like, I think my second album is actually much more edgy.
And more grown up.
More grown up and sophisticated, and cuts harder, I think, on issues. But I was moving into more clean material because I was doing so many colleges. And
some colleges ask for not to curse.
They say PG-13. I mean, and I can still do, like, one of my jokes that I now find very hacky
what's your own joke that you find?
The joke where I do the rap lyric thing where it's like pumping pussy like gas. And it was like one of my first jokes. It was the first joke I ever did on TV. Yeah. And like people, it was such a crowd pleaser. And I would open all my college shows with that because it just made them comfortable with me. And it was a sexual joke, but it's not a dirty joke in a way. It's just it's about a rap lyric. Yeah. I find it very hacky now, and I hope to never do it again. But I think college kids didn't want to hear about my divorce, and they didn't want to hear about advanced sex stuff, because most of the people I'd be performing for were virgins, and they were just, it was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it was uncomfortable for me. It'd be like performing for a bunch of teenagers and being like, do you know what squirting is? Like, God. Awful. It was like I was an aunt in the room being like, okay, kids, let's talk about your vulva. Everybody get out a mirror. You know, just too much for me. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to, you know, and just my material was naturally moving in this other direction anyway. But the Hobby Lobby thing, I couldn't do at certain colleges, because certain college kids, if I could tell I was at a college that was dumb, like for the dumber kids, I couldn't do this joke because they couldn't get it.
Yeah.
They were like crafting abortion. What? You know, like, and not that they don't know what those things are, but like the message of the joke is more.
You have to like pay attention for a while.
Yeah. Right. It also is a long story. And I would do it at like schools that I felt were smarter and they would love it. But I only did it a few times at colleges. So it wouldn't work.
So section three is the stores. Which feels very, what's interesting about it, it feels like, it's almost like a joke that a person who's not from America would move to America and write.
Yeah.
Because it's like.
About the stores. So I had to write that.
Yeah.
Because I did the joke, I did the show, I did a tour leading up to Edinburgh. I wanted to be ready for Edinburgh. I knew, I'd been advised, don't show up thinking that you're going to work it out because you're performing every night, which is a very American, be like, oh, I'm doing it every night. I'll figure it out when I get there. And they're like, no, the reviewers come on night one. You got to be ready. I was like, oh my God. So I took it very seriously, and I booked a tour. And in Nashville, I had some friends come, one of whom grew up in the UK. And she was like, so the concept of Hobby Lobby might be a bit of a problem for people in the UK because they just don't have big box stores the way we do, and mm-hmm. like you need an entry point that makes more sense and sets it up for them. Like, yes, we have stores, like big department stores and stuff, but it's just not like it is in America. So I wrote this for that.
Yeah, and in America.
I wrote it in America to get ready for Edinburgh, and it worked great in the UK. Like, but it works even better here because people get it even more.
Yeah.
And
it also has the BevMo joke is like the jokiest joke of the joke.
Yeah.
The BevMo joke, which is BevMo, they only sell beverages, dicks. They only sell dicks. Just mm-hmm. kidding. They sell sporting goods too, dicks.
Yeah. Nikki gave me the dicks line, and then I think I added
the tag.
She said you should say dicks. They only sell dicks. And then I added the just kidding. They sell sporting goods too, dicks. That gets such a big laugh anytime I do that.
It's truly a joke. It's like
yeah, it's a joke.
Yeah. The Amazon part. Why include the Amazon part? What do you think that? Where you say you could go to Amazon.
Just because I'm a logic queen. Like I get very caught up in logic, and it's why I usually don't like to give feedback on other comedians' jokes if they ask me, because I'm like, you will be caught in a tangle of logic problems if you ask me what I think. I'll be like, well, technically, that won't work because what you're saying is. I brought in the Amazon thing because I was like in my head being like, why didn't I just go home and order this online, you know, and in this immediate, it is a joke. There is a lot to be said. I mean, even though I don't consciously think about it, but it's a joke fundamentally also about capitalism and like how sad it makes us all feel of like, you know, and just how petulant we become in it. Just like, I want it now.
Yeah.
Like, where's my thing? I should have access to everything I want at all times, and it should be cheap. It's just such an American attitude, and it's killing the entire earth. It's really sick.
So we go into section 4, Cross the Threshold. You're now talking about Hobby Lobby. We're still not in the story.
It's such a fucking long joke.
It is great. I mean, it is.
There's a lot to it. I made sure there was a laugh every couple. I was like, I can't just be talking.
The Hobby Lobby part's really interesting because I think you'd expect to be like, now it's time to rail against Hobby Lobby, but it's almost like you try as hard as possible to not make it seem like, to try to present it evenly as possible.
Yeah.
You're like, I might say this. Their interpretation would be different.
Yeah.
They would say they went to the Supreme Court to fight for what they believe in, their right to refuse cover mm-hmm. certain, all that. Mm-hmm. Why do it that way? Why not just be like, time to rail against Hobby Lobby?
Because I, in a way, wanted to show how insidious what they were doing was. They would say this, and I want to just plainly say what they're doing so that the more intelligent people in the audience will understand that what they were doing was really fucked up.
Yeah.
That they believe that they are a corporate. And there was times when I would add that line and be like, as we know, corporations are people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that idea is dangerous and, you know, that it. So I probably could make that line even better if I worked on it more. But just part of it also, I made it very specific so that no one could argue with me about it. I always have imaginary future arguments mm-hmm. when I'm making anything. I'm always imagining the critique before it happens. And I wanted to make sure that I was getting my, because I'm also obsessed with the abortion debate.
Yeah.
Like I don't have the bravery yet to really get into it on stage because I do think it's just one of those topics that's very hard to talk about on stage. And even if you're someone who doesn't give a shit, it's still hard.
Yeah.
And I'm someone who really gives a shit about like the audience feeling comfortable. And so, you know, I'm like.
Yeah. If it takes you 10 minutes to set up a Hobby Lobby.
Yeah. So. I mean, this is the most I can do. So, but I'm obsessed with the arguing. So I've spent a lot of time reading both sides. What they argue mm-hmm. and really tried to dissect it down to the littlest details. So that's why I added in like certain types of birth control because Hobby Lobby did not actually try to ban all of it, mm-hmm. but it was certain types that they believe is abortion, but it's actually not, you know, that's why I always say it's like, this is a matter of belief.
Yeah.
And that is why it's so dangerous because it's, you know, they're imposing their beliefs on their employees and potentially because the arguments that they made to the Supreme Court have really, really bad consequences that can also affect like discrimination against people of different, you know, gender, race, religion. I mean, it opened a gate. Yeah. And like, that's how the far right is trying to actually dismantle our freedoms, not necessarily with your big butthead Trump in the office, although that helps their case. It's with these court cases, which is why it's so urgent that we get him out so we don't have four more years of him stacking the courts, you know, and opening these floodgates back to, like, you know, even more regressive than we were in the 50s, you know.
The section then has this part where you sort of have an internal monologue of why you're justifying going in.
Yeah.
Is it meant to sound kind of like bullshit? Like you're trying to be somewhat of an unreliable narrator, or not even you're the narrator being like this person. Yeah. You want to be like this. This is a justification. This is not real.
So I didn't actually think that when I went in there. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go fuck shit up. I'm just going to go see. I mean, I really wanted my basket. I wanted to see if they had it. and I'd never been in. And I was like, and my boyfriend was with me, which I don't bring this part into it. And he's been to Hobby Lobby many times. You know, he grew up in Spokane, Washington.
He grew up in a Hobby Lobby. He
did almost. His mother is an incredible quilter. His whole family is extremely crafty and like artsy, but they're also like very rural or suburban. So they're very interesting to me in this way. But so he's been to Hobby Lobby many times. He's like, you don't understand what Hobby Lobby is, Sarah. And I'm like, well, what? It's got to suck. And he's like, no, I think, you know, so he's like, and
did
it was
consider
literally
including him in the joke, or you're like, it's much.
No, it just was too much to add that him in. It didn't need it. But we literally were at this in Burbank. There's this long row of every store, like Michael's, Target, Dick's, you know, it's like, it's crazy. It's like, it's what America was. It's like the dream, you know, it's like big box after big box. And then across this big street, this huge intersection is like Hobby Lobby by itself, you know. And so he was like, we got to go.
Yeah.
So we went in there and I saw it. And
So this is essentially the midpoint of the joke. And we have not gone to the Hobby Lobby yet. But how does the sort of pacing evolve? Are you building out outs if sort of parts of it aren't working? Like,
oh yeah, I've abandoned ship before.
So you used to be like, you'll stop. Are there certain points where you're like, oh, and then I went to the Hobby Lobby and it sucked anyway? So
yeah, I mean, there have been times where I will go, you know what? I'll literally just say this. I'll be like, you guys aren't into this. I'm just gonna move on. And I'll be like, you can't handle this. You're not sophisticated enough. And then I usually get a laugh. Like, you don't deserve it.
You don't deserve it.
I'm gonna move on.
You don't get
it's
to know
okay.
what happened.
I'll talk about. Sometimes when I did colleges, I would be like, I would give them a choice. It'd be like, I have a joke that's like about this, or I have a joke about this. Which way do you want me to go? And they would yell out, and I would go in that direction. Sometimes they would go in the Hobby Lobby direction.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Choose your own adventure.
So section five, you're at the Hobby Lobby. Fun and games, promises.
Oh, wait, I wanted to say one thing about the past section.
Sure.
You said, did you go in? So this is what I actually do. I will bargain with myself morally. I'll go, I'm about to do something bad, but I'll make up for it. I'll carbon offset. That's like how in my head. I'll morally offset it. I'll make a donation. I'll make sure that I'm volunteer. You know, like, and I'm not in the Hobby Lobby sense, but like in my life, if I feel like I'm doing something that isn't morally pure. And we're talking, I mean, the most minor shit. I mean, truly, like, dumb level shit. Mm. It's not like, oh, I will steal this. And now I'll, you know, whatever. Anyway, so yeah.
So what did you want to convey? You know, like, essentially, this is it's almost the entire section is a bit of an act out. So what did you want to convey to about you in the Hobby Lobby to an audience? What do you, in so much as this is Sarah, the character you're talking about.
Yeah.
What do you want them to think about this person?
Just like, what would I be like if I was in my candy store that I was not supposed to be in? And I really wanted people to relate to that feeling of how impossible it is to be morally perfect in this country, and that we all face those little dilemmas every day if we're conscious. I mean, it doesn't even matter what side you're on. You know, it's like people will yell at you for, like, you shouldn't go to Salvation Army. They're a cult. they hate gay people. You shouldn't donate there. You shouldn't go in there. You know, there's a problem with every corporation or organization, almost everyone. Yeah. And if you dig, you'll be lost. You'll just won't be able to do anything with your life if you're trying to be pure, even, you know, along your lines.
This section has a sort of, I mean, it's not even a callback. It's a full further continuation of the section about inspirational quotes. To those who don't know, you open this set with a section about inspirational quotes. What is it about inspirational quotes? How did that emerge? How do you sort of feel like it ties sort of these things together?
That was one of the jokes that I had already written was like, this is gold and I've got to have this in my show. So I had to make it fit somehow. The callback fit perfectly because those quotes are everywhere in Hobby Lobby. Inspirational quotes on rustic pieces of driftwood in multiple fonts are just, it's just jam packed in that store. It started with actually Scott, my boyfriend's, family, like one of his cousins, her house is like just covered in it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we like counted one time, it was like 58 like signs. And that's when I started working on the joke. And that, so that joke was probably one of the first ones of this, collection of jokes that I had started. And I think it fits in because it is also speaks to the platitudes that we all like, you know, that one of the reasons those things are so annoying, and I got into this later in the Edinburgh show, which is that it was a story about my mom's funeral where it's platitudes. It's like, you know, she's with you. I saw a butterfly on my minivan this morning. And, you know, like, and it's, but it doesn't help and it doesn't make you feel good and it doesn't change anything. But it makes some people feel good when they see that. So I feel like I'm judging them. But anyway, for me, they're not specific enough. I like specificity, and that, and of course, those signs were everywhere in Hobby Lobby.
So so you buy the basket against your better judgment, or you just buy it, and then so section six, Trump surprise, it's a Trump joke. 11 minutes in, but it's different. I mean, the joke is that you're Trump. This is why Trump won. No, it's worse. I'm Trump. What about that angle in as a person who?
Yeah.
You know, hypothetically, a person reads you say Trump jokes are bad. They go see you at Edinburgh and you have this big thing and then surprise.
Yeah.
Why, if you're doing a Trump joke, why was it that, which is more
because
reflective?
One of my issues with Trump is that I feel sorry for him and I feel empathy for him and I feel that I shouldn't and I can't help it. And I actually have to limit the amount of times I will listen to him talk or see him. Because I have to have enough hatred against him in my heart to fight for what the good cause is, which is to get him out of office. I think he's horrible and he's evil. But I still feel empathy for him. And I, like, for instance, that picture that just came out with his tan on his face.
Yeah.
That's the type of thing that makes me start feeling sorry for him. And I relate. Sometimes he does things that I see myself in him because that's how I view everyone. Yeah. I'm just someone who goes, oh, I'm like that. I could see how I almost have too much empathy sometimes where it's like, I'm no longer standing up for myself and I'm letting someone like beat me down that is actually a wrong, bad person, but I can't let them. I'm like, no, but he's good. He didn't mean to do that. And, so that part is really because there's so many things Trump does. I mean, I could do a whole separate hour on things he does that I think I see myself doing and other people do, but that person shouldn't be president. That's why I'm not president. So that's like the end thing that I always come back to. But yeah.
I've heard you say in a recent interview that you are trying to be less of a people pleaser to the audience. I mean, this section is, you know, what is it like to sort of tell the audience why you're not a good person or what about you is not good? I mean, did you have to sort of build up to that? Was it hard to do this part? Or is it just sort of hard to do general?
That's easy for me to trash myself.
Got it.
Very easy for me to do that.
Then, I mean, in the reverse, in the post-Nanette, was it hard to trash yourself in a way that felt to have a certain amount of dignity?
No, because I felt what I was saying was universal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think whether people can admit it or not, we all have very childish, selfish parts of us. And some people are comfortable with those parts and some people aren't. And it's hard to admit that, you know, that's truly like, he is like a part of the psyche, yeah. like the id. It's very id like.
Yeah.
But it's the Trump is very specific to him, but it's like.
Like id, but shorter.
Yeah. And, but that's also part of why we should look at that and use it to defeat him,
mm-hmm.
you know, and understand what works against him. I mean, Nancy Pelosi tearing up that speech was on his level and it hurt, you know, like he yeah. hates that shit, you know, and not that I need him to hurt. I just want him gone.
Yeah.
The man is no way that guy has a great life. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, but maybe he does. He's drugged up enough. Maybe he doesn't feel any of it.
So section seven, the finale. You talk about Hobby Lobby and all the stuff that happens. We talked a little bit about
this how. This is my favorite part of the joke.
it's also should be noted that it's like arguably a third of the joke, and it's the epilogue. What I think is really interesting is you approach, especially Cheryl. You create this character and you feel bad for her. I think it's interesting you approach her with empathy and sort of sadness,
yeah.
which is why that comedic choice instead of sort of like everyone's favorite righteous indignation. Like mm-hmm. you could have been like, see, they're all hypocrites and blah, blah, yeah. blah. Why?
Because I truly believe that when all the just the racking of my brain and reading so many pro-life Twitter, like reasonable people who yeah. seem they're never Trumpers, but they're still so off from where I am. They're so far apart. I'd look for those commonalities and ways to feel empathy for them. And I think that it is important to do that to a point. I mean, like, you know, where there's a point where it's like, okay, now you're denying the humanity of everyone else and I no longer can abide by that, you know. But the Cheryl character, I grew up Cynthia, sorry. Ha, we listened to it just yeah. now, for sure.
We listened to the version where yeah. before you changed the name.
Sorry, Cynthia. Yeah, Cynthia is... shit, sorry. Cynthia is someone I know, you know? It's yeah. like, it's I grew up evangelical Christian, Southern Baptist, and I was around all this, and I understand where they're coming from. In fact, the museum thing... to me makes 100% sense to me. It's like, why would you have a museum without something yeah. actually old in there? What is the point? And so I was just so blown away. And that's the newest part of the joke because yeah. it happened in July. And I was just like, this is crazy. Like they have this museum and it's open. You can go to it. Yeah. You know, I need to go to it so I can like really feel it all. Well,
then
know.
The joke is now.
Then I'm going to have to bring it back yeah. and it's going to become like 30 minutes long. But yeah, I look for those things because I know that when I started out in comedy, I mean, I wasn't a very religious person by the time I got to New York. You know, yeah. I was not going to church anymore. But there's so much of my upbringing that I value. My values come from that. And there's parts of Christianity that I think are beautiful and like love, you know, and just it's a code that I live by, whether I'm calling it that or not. But when I got to New York, I would see a lot of people trashing religion in a way that made me yeah. suspicious if they'd ever experienced any kind of spiritual connection or faith in something or been in a community where there's a magical thing happening, that where there's love in a room where it's like you do. I've never spoken tongues, but like you can get slayed in the spirit. I mean, yeah. like. It's not something you, when you grow up in it and you have those experiences, it's so intense. And
it, so it'd be disingenuous to be cynical about certain parts of.
Yeah, I'm very cynical about a lot of religion, but I don't want that to, I want to come from a place of authority.
Yeah.
And I think so much authority comes from just simply understanding.
Yeah, it's also much more complicated.
It's so easy to go, they're just stupid.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I mean, yeah, maybe, but like they have a reason for what they're doing that is very real to them.
How do you end? So it's this big thing. How do you approach an ending of thing to be like, okay, we now have to land this plane that I took up as high as possible?
Oh, God, I don't even remember how it ends.
So it ends with, I mean, I have it written out. So
no, what's the very last line? I'll remember it as soon as you say it. You got this out.
From now on. They wanted to make the museum perfect, and I wanted my craft nook to be perfect. From now on, let's just agree to no longer do business with terrorists.
Yeah. You know, it's like lesson learned.
Yeah.
You know, but it's about a mutual respect of like walking away from one another, even though Hobby Lobby does not care about me in any way, shape, or form.
But it's an agree to disagree. We're both.
Well,
we're
what
all
can
flawed.
I do? Yeah. I mean, what I can do is not shop there, but I also know just me shopping there is not enough.
Yeah.
Huge boycotts work to an extent. They do work, but they have to be so big, which is part of why the Women's March in my mind is important. Something like that. You have to, Moshe Kasher said this when, because I worked at his show when the Women's March happened. He was like, you know, I was seeing all this stuff online about people criticizing it, and those critiques were valid. But also, he said, if you want a movement to go mainstream and actually make a huge impact, you're going to have to invite some assholes to the party. You can't be purists. Anyway, so it goes back to the theme.
Okay, so now on the other side of this joke, and as having seen comedy over the last few years, I think, though we can still maybe agree on sort of the idea that there's flaws in jokes about Trump in the most purest sense, but what have you learned about comedy? At, you know, I think even in that article you said there were people like, oh, Trump winning is good for comedy, which I think is a crazy thing to even to assert. But there has been shifts in comedy as a result that I would say I've seen, like, you'd say maybe comedy has improved, whatever that means. But for you, what have you seen? How have you dealt it with the situation that you laid out that you have found to be positive? What have you learned that is more effective? What has this joke taught you?
I really am proud of this joke because I haven't seen anyone do this.
Yeah.
To say these things about him or about this climate. I feel this is a unique joke. And part of it is because it's built on a real life experience that I had. But I did other jokes in that Edinburgh show that I realized while I was there, they were hacky.
Mm-hmm.
I heard through the curtain after someone going, all the American comedians are starting their show the same way. And I went, oh, fuck. So I changed that. But since coming back, I have seen so many of the same jokes. And sometimes it's the joke is I can't talk about Trump because blah, 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 blah.
Well, why is this joke good?
Well, this joke is great.
Yeah.
No, this joke is great because I think it goes to more of a core of the climate right now as opposed to what orange-haired, orangey Cheeto hand in chief, you know what I mean? Like, it's not those easy jokes. It's just more about the core of who we are, or at least who I am. And so that's why it's a more specific entry point into that. But, yeah.
I want to talk very briefly about the comedy Civil War. You recently wrote
I'm happy to talk about it on a podcast.
I
know what to say and what not
sure,
to say.
Sure. Yeah. To summarize, I think it's a overblown and sort of recklessly inflammatory name for what is
A
pretty niche thing, which is there's a certain subset of comedians and comedy fans who are sort of united around their sort of point of view, defending free speech at all costs, above other people's sort of safety even. Mm. There are certain events that sort of triggered this. The Louis C.K. being booked in clubs, they would defend Louis C.K. and the right for him to do it. Probably the biggest was then Shane Gillis being cast on SNL, then fired after it was revealed.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things he said. And then you wrote a piece recently and you talk about how you would often do these threats where you would respond to them.
Yeah.
But you recently decided not to do that anymore. Can you talk about that piece you wrote and summarize sort of what you learned?
So last summer I got into a dust up online with some comedy fans. I call them Shithead Island. And it's Shithead Island is the fandoms of certain comedy podcasts. And this is not an indictment necessarily on the hosts themselves. Some of them are probably really nice people or normal. I don't know. But the fans are so crazy that I don't want to ever visit Shithead Island because, and I'm using I will give you one real example. I did Opie and Anthony like twice years and years ago. Well, cut 2 years later, Opie gets all, you know, fucked up and fired because he does this racist tirade on Twitter. And when that happened, I mean, I hadn't said boo about it. I didn't even realize what was going on. And I hadn't tweeted about Opie. I was on the show for maybe 5 minutes total. Like years ago. And his fans were now tweeting me, you know, you better speak up for him or you're, you know, you're going to get it. Like, yeah. I mean, I was being harassed and I hadn't even said anything about it. And yeah. I was like, who is this? And I realized, oh, these are also the type of people that have been for years being mean to me online.
Yeah.
They follow me for some reason. And it was just like, oh, they're from there. They're from that area of fandom. And yeah. I don't, you know, look, I have been harassed by these people, this group of people, and I'm putting a big group, yeah. you know, big label on it, in many different ways over the years. And some of it has been really bad, like where I have been afraid to go. It has changed the way I operate when I'm on the road. Because when you see a whole Reddit thread of people joking mm-hmm. about raping you and killing you or wanting you to kill yourself and trying to figure out how to get me to kill myself, you can't help but wonder, what if one of these psychos shows up? And they're talking about, I'm going to go see her perform. Yeah. And they know I'm reading it, and they hope I see that, and they want me to feel fear, and they want me to feel awful. And it worked. I was afraid after that. I was like, what if one of these fucking psychos shows up and does something to me? And that's why I always say women comedians are brave, because we are publicly publishing where we're going to be all the time. Yeah. It's like, all it takes is one psycho to show up, and it's in the back of your head. It's kind of it's freaky, but for the most part, you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is, you know, but you can't help but feel a little afraid. But anyway, so I got in this dust up with some of these Shithead Island people last summer, and it was a really bad time. It was bleeding over into my personal life and causing conflict in personal life, and I had 2 days sleepless nights, like my anxiety just spiraling. I mean, like when I'm having a full blown anxiety attack, I am unable to sleep. I'm crying. It's a physical thing. It's like a panic attack, but less, you know. My heart rate is, I mean, I'm like sweating. I'm crying. I'm talking out loud. I'm like, no, but I'm gonna, you know, and it just triggered one, and I was so exhausted by it. And I was like, why am I doing this to myself? And in the end, I'm not gaining anything from being in these comedy debates online. But that was like the lead up to all of it. And what I realized is I wasn't really doing anything. I wasn't moving the needle. These are cyclical arguments. The same points are made over and over again. For a while, it was the "are women funny" argument. It was just like, why are we even having this? Is so stupid. Like, the same sides will say the same things. No one's mind has changed. This is stupid. And I got teased by a comedy friend of mine, which is in the article. Like, and it made me be like, oh, fuck, I can't do this anymore. You know, and you're getting people going. People, I think, started to assume that I'm a comedian that gets up on stage and does Nanette.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and it's just like, no, I actually don't even really get into this shit on stage.
Your comedy's not about critiquing.
No, comedy. And especially now my jokes are about something completely different. And it's just, I'm putting out a wrong impression of who I am. And I'm, you know, being trolled in a way that's hurting me and making me scared. Not scared physically, but like nervous to be in a club around some of the comedians that maybe I had a little dust up with. And that, I don't like that feeling. Like, that's dumb. Like, why? This is just, I'm not even involved in it. And but I care about who gets to do comedy, and I care about women in comedy feeling safe. And so I do get passionate about those things, but I don't think Twitter's the place for it anymore.
You talk about this idea of a coastal paradox, which is essentially measuring the coastline. If you zoom out, the more closely you measure it, the more detail it has, and actually the bigger it is.
Yeah.
And you tie that into sort of how Twitter minimizes sort of our the personality of people to sort of bite-sized ideas, and they're sort of one side or the
other. You're on this side, I'm on this side.
And then I was thinking about how a few things, which is sort of there's this idea that A.O. Scott talks about how all filmmakers are film critics in their way, and they use their films to sort of assert their value system.
Yeah.
Of what is good or is bad or whatever. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about those combined, and you've now, with some distance from it, and also thinking about this joke, which I think has same themes of that idea of a coastal paradox, do you now think that, like, oh, the best way to sort of convey what I think comedy, what I hope for comedy, is through my comedy itself?
it's, I realize the best way for me to deal with all these things is to create things. So like the essay I wrote, I love writing. And so if I get to write something like that, I feel much more satisfied than just firing off a tweet that is not nuanced in any way and starts putting me in a box and everyone else in another box. And so, yeah, my comedy, my book, you know, anything where it feels like an actual creative expression. Twitter has never been a medium for me that works. Mm. And so why, you know, I still use it because I want to like promote myself on it. And we are still reliant on that a little. But it's just not what it's, I'm not making things on there that are valuable.
Something I was thinking about with this joke is it's nearly 17 minutes long. And I was like, it like takes up space. It is sort of like, this is a big thing that...
Like, we're going to stop.
Yeah.
And we're going to get into this for
It's something like if an artist did a huge painting and made people reckon with that.
Yeah.
Instead, opposed to like, oh, little things are sweet. Does that resonate to you? It's like, do you feel like that's why it became so long?
Yeah. I mean, because I had more to say. And the audience had to go there with me. And I actually like... so grateful for British for the UK audience, Scottish, I'm like UK, British, all of it, because there was a lot of people there. But I'm grateful for those audiences because they actually they don't laugh, which is extremely stressful, but they're very engaged, and they want to learn from you, and they allowed me to do this and breathe.
They're just sort of like, we just want to know who you are.
Yeah, they want to know who you are. They want your pain.
and who you are is a valid way of spending time.
Yeah, they were like, and I would think I had bombed, and then I'd hear through the little curtain, I'd hear someone go, oh, it was the best show I've ever seen. I feel like, or people would apologize, they go, I'm sorry, I was the one laughing. I'm like, what? You are the only one that made me feel alive out there.
Does it make you want to do longer jokes? Do you think
Yeah. No, I right now I'm working on a joke about... and it's 9 minutes already, and it's about meditation and sleep, this sleep cast that I've been listening to. And it's so funny. I honestly could do an hour because there's more. I have so much more to say. And, you know, I'm like, that would be a really weird hour. But I could do it. I could try.
You should do it. Like, and part of it is you do meditation for, like, 20 of the minutes.
Exactly. We all get on the same page and we become present with each other. That's not a bad idea. But, But I'm also working on potentially doing Edinburgh again with something from my book. And we'll see. I don't know.
So that sound means it's time for our final segment, which is the laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because it's comedy, it's a laughing round.
Okay. wow.
Thanks.
Good job.
Do you have a favorite joke, street joke?
My sister wrote it.
That's okay.
I'll tell you. Where does the worst band in the world live?
Where?
Three doors down.
That's pretty good. is there a joke?
My friend wrote a tag. Where does the best band in the world live?
Where?
Pearl Jam.
That is funny.
That's amazing.
That is funny.
John Friedman wrote the tag.
Is there a joke that you wish you could steal in so much as it's a different dimension? Everything's exactly the same, but this comedian's joke is now your joke and you get to tell it. In other words, a lot of comedians think of like a joke you heard and you're like, oh, I wish I thought of that.
Yeah, oh, fuck. I can't think of anything right now.
Okay, passing is allowed.
All of Rory Scovel's work.
Pretending the microphone wire is a snake or whatever.
I love him.
You used to write for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Yeah. Are you allowed to say any questions you wrote?
Okay, so my favorite question I wrote, which I think they might have made a million-dollar question. I don't remember, but I categorized it as one. It was, in the movie Ferris Bueller, what painting does Cameron become lost in? I phrased it better, but and it's the grand, what it's like you have to know the movie and you have to know that the name of that painting. It's a great question.
You were an early blogger.
Oh yeah, I was an early blogger,
which was very important to me as a mid-tier mid-era blogger. You wrote for bestweekever.tv,
you did,
which was very seminal to me. Do you remember any headlines you wrote?
Oh, I remember being very proud of my, I made a video that disappeared and I watched every Kung Fu movie. I'm not kidding. Every Kung Fu movie, because my husband at the time was really into Kung Fu. And I noticed like whenever there was these scenes where they would just make expressions like they were trying to push out poop.
Mm-hmm.
And I called it Kung Poo. And it just made a montage of Kung Fu guys going, it's the dumbest thing I've ever made. And no one liked it. But I did.
You did a video where you begged Justin Timberlake to make music again that sort of ended his... Like, I feel like...
It worked.
He made music again. But now I feel like he is not known as a musician or an actor.
Yeah, we ruined him.
Do you think about that?
I do. I've thought a lot about Justin Timberlake because I feel so... I'm upset with him right now. He's gone in a way that I'm not... I don't know. I have such complicated feelings about him. I didn't like what he did at the Super Bowl. I didn't like his last album. And I didn't like what he did to his wife recently. He was holding hands with a co-star on a balcony in New Orleans. What in the world were you thinking, man? I don't care what was going on. You fool. You're famous. Don't do that shit. Don't humiliate your wife.
Last one. Do you have a joke that has never worked? You've tried it a bunch of times. It never works. But you're like, that's funny. You'll go to the grave being like, I have this one funny joke. No one got it.
I do a joke, which I actually think is, I stopped doing it, one, because it wouldn't get laughs, but also because started to feel hacky already, which was, I'm not one of those feminists that wants to kill all men. But what if we just did one? And then I go, and that usually gets a laugh. Yeah. But then I'll go, I mean, calm down. We'll pick a bad one. And then I'd cover my eyes and I'd like just point. And the joke is that all men are bad.
Yeah, yeah.
and it brings it all around to kill all men. But people don't get what I'm doing, or they're like, you are taking it too far, you shrill bitch. How dare you? So I kind of abandon it. Because there's a lot of kill all men jokes right now amongst women comics. And it's starting to feel... old already, but I do like that joke.
The end.
The end!
The end.
Thank you.
That's it for another episode. You can listen to Sarah's Live, Laugh, Love wherever you buy or stream music. You can pre-order a copy of her memoir, Grand, which comes out August 11th wherever books are sold. Follow Sarah on social media, at SarahSchaefer1. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Art Chung, and Camila Salazar. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Editorial assistance from Amanda Gordon. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing round suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week. Have a good one.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big?
Ooh.
Summarize with AI in a click.
Click, click, click.
Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Canva.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.